Scientists say human-caused climate change has been a big factor in the extreme heat waves around the globe.
More often, we see that every study that we do, we see the fingerprint of climate change intensifying this type of events of heat waves.
Plus, chaos across Israel as thousands of doctors walk out and mass protests escalate after the government's vote on a divisive judicial overhaul.
All the extreme side of the political map getting more extreme and more angry.
And a moving tribute to a slain black teen, President Joe Biden calls for Americans to honor the nation's history, even the painful moments. Today is Wednesday, July 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good morning, I'm Lori London in Washington. Human-induced climate change has played an absolutely overwhelming role in the extreme heat waves gripping the globe this month in North America, Europe, and China, according to a report by scientists published on Tuesday. Researchers say the deadly hot spells could not have happened without the continuing buildup of warming gases in the air. Associated Press correspondent Jennifer King reports.
Scientists with World Weather Attribution found that record-breaking heat waves in the American Southwest and Southern Europe were virtually impossible without climate change that has been increasing heat since the mid-1800s. Using tree rings and other stand-ins for temperature records, climate scientists found unusually strong heat waves are becoming more common and say this month is likely the hottest Earth has been in about 120,000 years. The study found the increase in heat-trapping gases made the heat wave gripping China 50 times more likely and are making the spells in the United States and Mexico hotter by 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And in Europe by 4.5 degrees. Scientists warn that intense heat waves can kill people, crops, and livestock and lead to more drought and wildfires. I'm Jennifer King.
A firefighting plane crashed while dropping water on a wildfire in southern Greece on Tuesday, killing both Air Force pilots as authorities battled blazes that have been raging out of control for days across the country. Residents and business owners say they're struggling to grapple with the destruction.
My life now, it's stopping. My restaurant and all, everything, it's take a fire. Also my mom's house and my house in the village. I don't know what happened.
Summer wildfires blamed on climate change have also struck a number of other Mediterranean countries amid the extreme heat. The UN nuclear watchdog chief says his staff has reported seeing landmines placed around the Russian-occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant in Ukraine. More from Associated Press correspondent Karen Shamis.
International Atomic Energy Agency Director General Rafael Mariano Grossi said the mines flouted IAEA safety standards. Grossi added that the presence of mines located between the site's internal and external perimeter barriers increased psychological pressure on plant staff. Nevertheless, Grossi confirmed that if any of the mines exploded, it should not affect the site's nuclear safety and security systems. I'm Karen Chamas.
The State Department says a former American Marine who had been freed by Russia last year has been injured while fighting in Ukraine. Details now from Associated Press correspondent Ed Donahue.
Trevor Reed got out of Russia in a prisoner swap.
That government is really sincerely evil. At all levels, from the top to the bottom.
A source tells the AP Reed was wounded several weeks ago in Ukraine. The State Department says he was taken to Germany for medical care. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre says Reed was not in Ukraine on behalf of the U.S.
Since the beginning of the war, we've been very clear. We have warned that U.S. citizens who travel to Ukraine, especially with the purpose of participating in fighting there, that they face significant risk.
Reed's presence in Ukraine could complicate U.S. efforts to win the release of two other Americans still detained by Russia. Ed Donahue, Washington.
Russia on Tuesday said Western countries, particularly the United States, were putting, quote, unprecedented pressure on African countries to not take part in a Russia-Africa summit this week. We hear more from Angela Johnston with Reuters.
The Kremlin on Tuesday accused the West, and particularly the United States, of trying to sabotage its showcase Russia-Africa summit later this week. Spokesman Dmitry Peskov said African states had been subjected to, quote, unprecedented pressure not to take part. In essence, he said, they do not accept the sovereign right of African states to independently determine their partners for cooperation and mutual interaction in various fields. The St. Petersburg summit on Thursday and Friday will be attended by President Vladimir Putin. He's expected to hold intensive one-on-one talks with individual African leaders on everything from trade and security to grain supplies. It's part of a concerted push for influence, which has also been echoed by the West, against the backdrop of war in Ukraine. It also takes place after Moscow announced last week that it was leaving the Black Sea Grain Deal. That agreement had allowed Ukraine to safely export grain from its seaports. Here's Peskov speaking on Tuesday.
It is more important than ever to get together with the Africans and discuss, in particular, food obligations and the reasons for the failure of the grain deal, Russia's efforts to support the world markets, Russia's responsible approach to this, and what obligations on whose part were not met.
Russia has spoken of the possibility of supplying cheap or free grain to Africa's poorest nations to replace Ukrainian grain and make up for any shortfall. 49 African delegations have confirmed their participation in the St. Petersburg summit, a Russian diplomat was cited as saying by the TASS news agency earlier this month. Around half would be represented by their head of state or government.
Angela Johnston with Reuters reporting. Protests have escalated in Israel following Monday's passage of a law to restrict judicial power, a move that critics say threatens democracy. Tens of thousands of Israelis have blocked roads and say they will continue to protest. Linda Gradstein reports for VOA from Jerusalem.
The law to limit the Supreme Court's power to overturn government ministers' decisions passed 64-0 after the opposition boycotted the final vote in the Israeli parliament. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said critics of the bill are overreacting. He said that Israel will continue to be democratic and liberal and will safeguard individual rights of all citizens. But many disagree, fearing this is only the first step in a process of taking power away from the Supreme Court and consolidating it in the hands of the right-wing government. After the law passed, the protests escalated with tens of thousands of protesters blocking roads in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and clashing with police officers. Police used water cannons and horses to disperse the protesters, arresting and injuring several people. While Israel has seen large-scale protests in the past, observers say there has not been a sustained movement that lasted more than 6 months like this one. David Horovitz is the editor-in-chief of The Times of Israel.
These protests are different. I think the stakes are different and the participation is different. So the bottom line is that for the people, certainly the people leading and many of the people participating in the protest, there's a belief that the current Israeli government is bent on remaking not merely Israeli sort of policies and political agenda, but the way Israel is governed.
7 months of mass demonstrations against the judicial overhaul hit a new peak in the last week before the vote, as tens of thousands marched from Tel Aviv to the parliament in Jerusalem.
We have to do everything we can in order to keep our democracy, and this is what we can do. And it will be a pity if our government will ignore all these people that are coming here to Jerusalem, that are protesting all around Israel.
Besides the demonstrations, more than 10,000 Israeli army reservists, including hundreds in elite units, say they will stop reporting for volunteer reserve duty if the judicial overhaul laws are passed. They say they refuse to serve a non-democratic regime. Military leaders warn that the reservists' refusal to report would harm Israel's ability to fight in a future conflict. Jonathan Golan is from a group known as the Brothers in Arms Movement.
I'm older, so I no longer do active service, but both my sons, who are actively in the reserves, have signed an affidavit that they will stop serving. My friends who are here around us have all signed that they will stop serving because, again, none of us who are liberal Democrats want to be in the armed forces of a dictatorship.
Proponents of the judicial overhaul say the law just passed is only the first step of their reform package. Opponents have already appealed to the Supreme Court against the law and say they will continue their protests until the judicial overhaul is scrapped. Linda Gradstein for VOA News, Jerusalem.
We're We're following these other stories from around the world. Taliban authorities in Afghanistan enforced a nationwide ban on beauty salons Tuesday after a one-month deadline for owners to close the businesses, leaving tens of thousands of women without work in a country grappling with poverty. The top decision-making body of China's rubber-stamp parliament voted Tuesday to oust its foreign minister and reappoint his predecessor to the role. Analysts say the personnel reshuffle reflects turmoil in China's diplomatic system that could have a negative impact on Beijing's engagement with other countries. Airstrikes and artillery barrages from Sudan's warring generals killed at least 16 people in a Khartoum neighborhood on Tuesday. After more than 100 days of war, the latest bombardments added to a toll of at least 3,900 killed nationwide. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The European Space Agency's Aeolus satellite has been in orbit for 5 years, 2 years past its planned mission of monitoring wind activity on Earth. With its fuel supply nearly exhausted, the spacecraft, affected by Earth's gravity, atmosphere, and solar activity, began falling from its normal orbit on June 19th. Instead of letting it deorbit naturally, the space agency is performing a first-of-its-kind assisted re-entry of the defunct spacecraft. ESA's intervention began on July 24th with a series of maneuvers to steer its descent. Final commands will be sent to the satellite on July 28th. When it reaches 80 kilometers above Earth, it's expected most of the spacecraft will begin to burn up as it travels through the atmosphere. Any remaining debris has been targeted to fall in a remote area of the Atlantic Ocean. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Lori London. Chinese surveillance ships in international waters off of Australia are monitoring the largest ever military drills involving the U.S. and Australia. Defense officials expect the high-tech spy ships to remain outside Australia's territorial waters during Talisman Sabre. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
30,000 military personnel from more than a dozen countries are participating in Talisman Sabre, including troops from Canada, Germany, Japan, and the United Kingdom. Australia is monitoring two Chinese surveillance ships. One is reported to be stationed in international waters off Shoalwater Bay in the state of Queensland, where it's closely monitoring the drills. Australia has made contact with the Chinese vessel, which gave a courteous response, according to a senior Australian military officer. Professor John Blaxland, head of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Australian National University's Coral Bell School of Asia-Pacific Affairs, believes that surveillance of the war games has become routine for China. He told VOA that it will make Australia and its allies more alert to any potential threat in the future.
China is a potential adversary. China is looking to collect information, and that in doing so, it plans to be in a position potentially to use it against us. That is having a very much a sobering effect on military practitioners in the army, navies, and air forces of all those participating nations. So, yes, it is sobering. Yes, it is plausible that it could be used against us, and it is to a certain extent meant to intimidate. But it is, in a sense, part of healthy competition, really.
Drills are taking place in the states of Queensland, Western Australia, and New South Wales, as well as the Northern Territory. Operation Talisman began a decade ago. This year's event is the largest in terms of its geographical area and the number of countries taking part. It includes amphibious landings, ground force manoeuvres, air combat, and maritime operations. Soldiers from Australia, the United States, Japan, and South Korea carried out a joint live fire demonstration at the Shoalwater Bay training area in Queensland on July 22 to launch this year's war games. United States Secretary of the Navy Carlos Del Toro said in a July 21 statement that the exercise increases our ability to work together in the countering challenges we may face here in the Indo-Pacific region. The drills are scheduled to run until early August. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
As monsoon rains batter India early in July, authorities released excess water into the rivers that flow into neighboring and arch-rival Pakistan. While this process is normal, Pakistanis who were also facing intense rains were taken by surprise as the water came much earlier than expected, prompting mass evacuations. VOA Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman visited villages along the banks of the Sutlej River.
In the village of Bhikki Vind near the India-Pakistan border in Punjab, Pakistanis are feeling the effects of heavy monsoon rains in India. On the edge of the Sutlej River, a string of orange flags marks the road along flooded fields. Engine-powered rescue boats are the only mode of transportation on the river that rose to almost 15 meters from the usual 9 to 11 meters. Irshad Bibi says she is catching a ride on a rescue boat to take her granddaughters back to the village from where they evacuated earlier. Although this area received heavy rains, the Sutlej swelled on the Pakistani side, largely from excess water India released this month as the monsoon battered its northern states. The river is shared between the rival neighbors through a 1960 treaty. As locals cannot safely use their own boats in the high and fast-moving water, rescue boats run several times a day to transport people and livestock. Across the river, in the village of Gatti Kalanjar, water damage to the crops is visible. Mohammed Rashid says he feels awful as his sesame crop worth a few thousand dollars is lost. Heavy monsoon rains are becoming frequent in both India and Pakistan. As experts say, the region experiences the effects of climate change. The timing of the flooding in Sutlej, the worst since 1988, is unusual. An irrigation department officer in Punjab, Rashid Akhtar, says normally the flood situation arises between August and October. But this year, the waters came in July, which was completely unexpected. To save precious lives and resources, observers say villages should be moved away from areas that fall in the riverbed. But it's not so simple. The land was allotted more than seven decades ago when India gained independence from British rule and Pakistan was created. Mohammed Rashid says he will live and die here as he has nowhere else to go. For now, most of those evacuated have returned and migrants are resuming work. But as monsoon rains continue to drench India and Pakistan, the fate of citizens on both sides of the Sutlej River remains connected. Sara Zaman, VOA News, Bhikki Vind, Punjab, Pakistan.
A growing number of Kurdish women in northeast Syria are signing up for the local traffic police force. The development is helping break stereotypes about the role of women in society. VOA's Zana Omer has the story from Qamishli, narrated by Sirwan Kajo.
Asya Muhammad controls traffic on this busy street in the Kurdish-majority city of Qamishli in northeast Syria. The 24-year-old police officer says this job has significantly empowered her.
My family was helpful. They encouraged me to join this line of work to better myself and encourage my female peers to do the same.
The Kurdish region in Syria is the only place in the war-torn country where female traffic officers exist. Many residents believe hiring women for these types of jobs helps break down stereotypes about them in this part of the world.
Women have proven themselves in all fields of work. They aren't supposed to do only desk jobs because doing that limits their potential. Women here can do the job.
The Kurdish-led Autonomous Administration of North and East Syria was established in 2014 with a co-presidency system in which men and women lead government agencies. But the traffic administration here also wants to create equal gender representation in the actual workforce. Currently, females make up 30% of its workforce.
There were a few obstacles in the beginning, but we were able to have a strong foothold within the traffic administration, whether through putting women in administrative positions or deploying them to the field.
Asya Muhammad says that she and her female colleagues have shown through this job that women can do any work if circumstances and customs allow. For Zana Omar in Qamishli, Syria, Sirwan Kejo, VOA News.
Emmett Till was 14 years old in August 1955 when he was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by two white men in the U.S. state of Mississippi after Emmett allegedly paid inappropriate attention to a white woman. Emmett and his mother, Mamie Till Mobley, became catalysts for the civil rights movement in the United States. President Joe Biden honored them on Tuesday. VOA's Laurel Bowman has the story.
U.S. President Joe Biden, surrounded by Emmett Till's family members and government officials, signed the document Tuesday.
The proclamation I'm signing establishes the Emmett Till, Mamie Till Mobley National Monument.
Emmett Till was a black teenager who was kidnapped, tortured, and killed by white men in Mississippi in the summer of 1955 after he was accused of whistling at a white woman. His mother, Mamie Till Mobley, became a civil rights advocate following her son's death. Lonnie Bunch, the secretary of the Smithsonian and the founding director of its National Museum of African American History and Culture, spoke about Till's mother and the casket displayed at the museum.
The one that resonates with me that makes me cry every day is Emmett Till's casket. What I realized is that the casket was really not a way to talk about Emmett Till's broken body, but it was a way to talk about the strength of women. Here is a black woman at the worst moment of her life said, I will use that to challenge America, to reinvigorate or reignite the civil rights movement.
Chicago resident John Moore lives across the street from Till's childhood home.
Explain to my kids what happened and at the time it happened. And it was hard for them to believe, and it's hard for young people to believe now what happened back in those days. But we're going to continue to go forward. We're going to continue to fight for our rights. We're not going to go back.
The National Monument comprises 5.7 acres across three separate historic sites in Illinois, where Till's funeral took place, and in Mississippi, where he was slain and his alleged murderers acquitted. President Joe Biden.
Telling the truth and the full history of our nation is important. Supporting our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, to our nation as a whole.
The two men accused of killing Till later admitted to the murder in a magazine interview. Laurel Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, we thank you so much for joining us. Until next time, I'm Lori London in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is sending additional military assets to waterways in the Middle East to deter malicious and destabilizing behavior by Iran. In response to a number of recent alarming events in the Strait of Hormuz, the Secretary of Defense has ordered the deployment of the destroyer USS Thomas Hudner, F-35 fighters and F-16 fighters to the U.S. Central Command Area of Responsibility to defend U.S. interests and safeguard freedom of navigation in the area, said Deputy Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh. Most recently, on July 5th, the Iranian Navy attempted to illegally seize two merchant ships in the Strait of Hormuz and the Gulf of Oman. One attempt included an Iranian Navy ship firing upon the merchant vessel, noted spokesperson Singh. In both cases, the Iranian vessels left the scene when the USS McFall, a guided missile destroyer, arrived on the scene. The two merchant vessels were able to continue their journeys. Other ships have not been as fortunate. Earlier this year, Iran seized two oil tankers in less than a week. The U.S. Naval Forces Central Command noted that since 2021, Iran has harassed, attacked, or seized nearly 20 internationally flagged merchant vessels, presenting a clear threat to regional maritime security and the global economy. The United States has a number of assets already in the region to help secure vital waterways, including A-10 aircraft. As U.S. National Security Council Coordinator John Kirby said, the additional assets are being deployed because of an increased level of activity in Iranian attacks. They have become more bellicose, more active, and more dangerous to peaceful maritime shipping in the Gulf region, he said. The Secretary of Defense wants to make sure, as he should, that we've got the proper capabilities and assets readiness in place to deal with that. Pentagon Deputy Spokesperson Singh declared, "We call upon Iran to immediately cease these destabilizing actions that threaten the free flow of commerce through this strategic waterway, of which the world depends on for more than one-fifth of the world's oil supply."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.